Why do we come here? Chris says. To see the lake. He doesn't like this. He senses falseness and frowns deep, trying to find the right question to expose it. I just hate this, he says. A tourist lady looks at him with surprise, then resentment. Well, what can we do, Chris? I asked. We just have to keep going until we find out what's wrong, or find out why we don't know what's wrong. Do you see that? He doesn't answer. The lady pretends not to be listening, but her motionlessness reveals that she is. We walk toward the motorcycle, and I try to think of something, but nothing comes. I see he's crying a little, and now looks away to prevent me from seeing it. We wind down out of the park to the south. I said the assistant chairman for the Committee on Analysis of Ideas and Study of Methods was shocked. What he was so shocked about was that Phaedrus didn't know he was at the locus of what is probably the most famous academic controversy of the century, what a California university president described as the last attempt in history to change the course of an entire university. Phaedrus's reading turned up a brief history of that famous revolt against empirical education that had taken place in the early 30s. The Committee on Analysis of Ideas and Study of Methods was a vestige of that attempt. The leaders of the revolt were Robert Maynard Hutchins, who had become president of the University of Chicago, Mortimer Adler, whose work on the psychological background of the law of evidence was somewhat similar to work being done at Yale by Hutchins, Scott Buchanan, a philosopher and mathematician, and most important of all for Phaedrus, the present chairman of the committee, who was then a Columbia University Spinozist and medievalist. Adler's study of evidence, cross-fertilized by a reading of classics of the Western world, resulted in a conviction that human wisdom had advanced relatively little in recent times. He consistently harked back to St. Thomas Aquinas, who had taken Plato and Aristotle and made them part of his medieval synthesis of Greek philosophy and Christian faith. The work of Aquinas and of the Greeks, as interpreted by Aquinas, was to Adler the capstone of the Western intellectual heritage. Therefore, they provided a measuring rod for anyone seeking the good books. In the Aristotelian tradition, as interpreted by the medieval scholastics, man is counted a rational animal capable of seeking and defining the good life and achieving it. When this first principle about the nature of man was accepted by the president of the University of Chicago, it was inevitable that it would have educational repercussions. The famous University of Chicago Great Books Program and the reorganization of the university structure along Aristotelian lines, and the establishment of the college in which a reading of classics was initiated in 15-year-old students, were some of the results. Hutchins had rejected the idea that an empirical scientific education could automatically produce a good education. Science is value-free. The inability of science to grasp quality as an object of inquiry makes it impossible for science to provide a scale of values. Adler and Hutchins were concerned fundamentally with the oughts of life, with values, with quality, and with the foundations of quality in theoretical philosophy. Thus, they had apparently been traveling in the same direction as Phaedrus, but had somehow ended with Aristotle and stopped there. There was a clash. Even those who were willing to admit Hutchins' preoccupation with quality were unwilling to grant the final authority to Aristotelian tradition to define values. They insisted that no values can be fixed, and that a valid modern philosophy need not reckon with ideas as they are expressed in the books of ancient and medieval times. The whole business seemed to many of them merely a new and pretentious jargon of weasel concepts. Phaedrus didn't know quite what to make of this clash, but it certainly seemed to be close to the area he wished to work in. He also felt that no values can be fixed, but that this is no reason why values should be ignored or that values do not exist as reality. He also felt antagonistic to the Aristotelian tradition as a definer of values, but he didn't feel this tradition should be left unreckoned with. The answer to all this was somehow deeply enmeshed in it, and he wanted to know more. Of the four who had created such a furor, The present chairman of the committee was the only one now left. Perhaps because of this reduction in rank, perhaps for other reasons, his reputation among persons Phaedrus talked to wasn't one of geniality. His geniality was confirmed by none and sharply refuted by two, one the head of a major university department who described him as a holy terror, and another who held a graduate degree in philosophy from the University of Chicago, who said the chairman was well known for graduating only carbon copies of himself. Neither of these advisers was by nature vindictive, and Phaedrus felt what they said was true. This was further confirmed by a discovery made at the department office. He wanted to talk to two graduates of the committee to find out more of what it was about, and had been told that the committee had granted only two PhDs in its history. Apparently, to find room in the sun for a reality of quality, he would have to fight and overcome the head of his own committee, whose Aristotelian outlook made it impossible even to get started, and whose temperament appeared to be extremely intolerant of opposing ideas. It all added up to a very gloomy picture. He then sat down and penned to the chairman of the committee on analysis of ideas and methods at the University of Chicago a letter which can only be described as a provocation to dismissal, in which the writer refuses to skulk quietly out the back door, but instead creates a scene of such proportions the opposition is forced to throw him out the front door, thus giving weight to the provocation it didn't formerly have. Afterward, he picks himself up out of the street and, after making sure the door is completely closed, shakes his fist at it, dusts himself off, and says, "Oh, well, I tried," and in this way absolves his conscience. Phaedrus's provocation informed the chairman that his substantive field was now philosophy, not English composition. However, he said, the division of study into substantive and methodological fields was an outgrowth of the Aristotelian dichotomy of form and substance, which non-dualists had little use for, the two being identical. He said he wasn't sure, but the thesis on quality appeared to turn into an anti-Aristotelian thesis. If this was true, he had chosen an appropriate place to present it. Great universities proceeded in a Hegelian fashion, and any school which could not accept a thesis contradicting its fundamental tenets was in a rut. This, Phaedrus claimed, was the thesis the University of Chicago was waiting for. He admitted the claim was grandiose, and that value judgments were actually impossible for him to make, since no person could be an impartial judge of his own cause. But if someone else were to produce a thesis which purported to be a major breakthrough between Eastern and Western philosophy, between religious mysticism and scientific positivism, he would think it of major historic importance, a thesis which would place the university miles ahead. In any event, he said, no one was really accepted in Chicago until he'd rubbed someone out. It was time Aristotle got his. Just outrageous. And not just provocation to dismissal, either. What comes through even more strongly is megalomania, delusions of grandeur, of complete loss of ability to understand the effect of what he was saying on others. He had become so caught up in his own world of quality metaphysics, he couldn't see outside it anymore, and since no one else understood this world, he was already done for. I think he must have felt at the time that what he was saying was true, and it didn't matter if his manner or presentation was outrageous or not. There was so much to it, he didn't have time for prettying it up. If the University of Chicago was interested in the aesthetics of what he was saying, rather than the rational content, they were failing their fundamental purpose as a university. This was it. He really believed. It wasn't just another interesting idea to be tested by existing rational methods. It was a modification of the existing rational methods themselves. Normally, when you have a new idea to present in an academic environment, you're supposed to be objective and disinterested in it. But this idea of quality took issue with that very supposition, of objectivity and disinterestedness. These were mannerisms appropriate only to dualistic reason. Dualistic excellence is achieved by objectivity, but creative excellence is not. He had the faith that he had solved a huge riddle of the universe, cut a Gordian knot of dualistic thought with one word, quality, and he wasn't about to let anyone tie that word down again. And in believing, he couldn't see how outrageously megalomaniacal his words sounded to others. Or if he saw it, didn't care. What he said was megalomaniacal, but suppose it was true. If he was wrong, who would care? But suppose he was right. To be right and throw it away in order to please the predilections of his teachers, that would be the monstrosity. And so he just did not care how he sounded to others. It was a totally fanatic thing. He lived in a solitary universe of discourse in those days. No one understood him, and the more people showed how they failed to understand him and disliked what they did understand, the more fanatic and unlikable he became. His provocation to dismissal was given an expected reception. Since his substantive field was philosophy, he should apply to the philosophy department, not the committee. Phaedrus dutifully did this, then he and his family loaded their car and trailer with all they owned and said goodbye to their friends, and were about to start. Just as he locked the doors of the house for the last time, the mailman appeared with a letter. It was from the University of Chicago. It said he was not admitted there. Nothing more. Obviously, the chairman of the Committee on Analysis of Ideas and Study of Methods had influenced the decision. Phaedrus borrowed some stationery from the neighbors and wrote back to the chairman that since he had already been admitted to the Committee on Analysis of Ideas and Study of Methods, he would have to remain there. This was a rather legalistic maneuver, but Phaedrus by this time had developed a kind of combative canniness. This deviousness, the quick shuffle out the philosophy door, seemed to indicate that the chairman, for some reason, was unable to throw him out the front door of the committee, even with that outrageous letter in hand, and that gave Phaedrus some confidence. No side doors, please. They were going to have to throw him out the front door or not at all. Maybe they wouldn't be able to. Good. He wanted this thesis not to owe anyone anything. We traveled down the eastern shore of Klamath Lake on a three-lane highway that contains a lot of 1920s feeling. That's when these three-laners were all made. We pull in for lunch at a roadhouse, which belongs to this era, too. Wooden frame badly in need of paint, neon beer signs in the window, gravel and engine drippings for a front lawn. Inside, the toilet seat is cracked and the washbowl is covered with grease streaks, but on my way back to our booth, I take a second look at the owner behind the bar. A 1920s face. Uncomplicated, uncool, and unbowed. This is his castle. We're his guests. And if we don't like his hamburgers, we'd better shut up. When they arrive, the hamburgers with giant raw onions are tasty, and the bottled beer is fine. A whole meal for a lot less than you'd pay at one of those old ladies' places with plastic flowers in the window. As we eat, I see on the map we've taken a wrong turn way back, and could have gotten to the ocean much quicker by another route. It's hot now. A West Coast sticky hotness, which after the Western Desert hotness is very depressing. Really, this is just transported east, all of this scene, and I'd like to get to the ocean where it's cool as soon as possible. I think about this all around the southern shore of Klamath Lake. Sticky hotness and 1920s funk. That was the feeling of Chicago that summer. When Phaedrus and his family arrived in Chicago, he took up residence near the university and, since he had no scholarship, began full-time teaching of rhetoric at the University of Illinois, which was then downtown at Navy Pier, sticking out into the lake, funky and hot. Classes were different from those in Montana. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 9, Side 2. Classes were different from those in Montana. The top high school students had been skimmed off to the Champaign and Urbana campuses, and almost all the students he taught were a solid, monotonous C. When their papers were judged in class for quality, it was hard to distinguish among them. Phaedrus, in other circumstances, probably would have invented something to get around this. But now this was just bread-and-butter work for which he couldn't spare creative energy. His interest lay to the south, at the other university. He entered the University of Chicago registration lineup, announced his name to the registering professor of philosophy, and noticed a slight setting of the eyes. The professor of philosophy said, "Oh, yes, the chairman had asked that he be registered in an ideas and methods course, which the chairman himself was teaching," and gave him the schedule of the course. Phaedrus noted that the time set for the class conflicted with his schedule at Navy Pier, and chose instead another one, Ideas and Methods 251, Rhetoric. Since rhetoric was his own field, he felt a little more at home here, and the lecturer wasn't the chairman. The lecturer was the professor of philosophy, now registering him. The professor of philosophy's eyes, formerly set, now became wide. Phaedrus returned to his teaching at Navy Pier and his reading for his first class. It was now absolutely necessary that he study as he had never studied before, to learn the thought of classic Greece in general, and of one classic Greek in particular, Aristotle. Of all the thousands of students at the University of Chicago who had studied the ancient classics, it's doubtful that there was ever a more dedicated one. The main struggle of the university's great books program was against the modern belief that the classics had nothing of any real importance to say to a 20th century society. To be sure, the majority of students taking the courses must have played the game of nice manners with their teachers and accepted, for purposes of understanding, the prerequisite belief that the ancients had something meaningful to say. But Phaedrus, playing no games at all, didn't just accept this idea. He passionately and fanatically knew it. He came to hate them vehemently, and to assail them with every kind of invective he could think of, not because they were irrelevant, but for exactly the opposite reason. The more he studied, the more convinced he became that no one had yet told the damage to this world that had resulted from our unconscious acceptance of their thought. Around the southern shore of Klamath Lake, we pass through some suburban-type development, and then leave the lake to the west, toward the coast. The road goes up now into the forests of huge trees, not at all like the rain-starved forests we've been through. Huge Douglas firs are on either side of the road. On the cycle, we can look up along their trunks, straight up, for hundreds of feet as we pass between them. Chris wants to stop and walk among them, and so we stop. While he goes for a walk, I lean my back as carefully as possible against a big slab of Douglas fir bark, and look up and try to remember. The details of what he learned are lost now, but from events that occurred later, I know he absorbed tremendous quantities of information. He was capable of doing this on a near-photographic basis. To understand how he arrived at his condemnation of the classic Greeks, it's necessary to review in summary form the mythos over logos argument, which is well known to scholars of Greek and is often a cause of fascination with that area of study. The term logos, the root of logic, refers to the sum total of our rational understanding of the world. Mythos is the sum total of the early historic and prehistoric myths which preceded the logos. The mythos includes not only the Greek myths, but the Old Testament, the Vedic hymns, and the early legends of all cultures which have contributed to our present world understanding. The mythos over logos argument states that our rationality is shaped by these legends, that our knowledge today is in relation to these legends, as a tree is in relation to the little shrub it once was. One can gain great insights into the complex overall structure of the tree by studying the much simpler shape of the shrub. There's no difference in kind or even difference in identity, only a difference in size. Thus, in cultures whose ancestry includes ancient Greece, one invariably finds a strong subject-object differentiation because the grammar of the old Greek mythos presumed a sharp natural division of subjects and predicates. In cultures such as the Chinese, where subject-predicate relationships are not rigidly defined by grammar, one finds a corresponding absence of rigid subject-object philosophy. One finds that in the Judeo-Christian culture, in which the Old Testament word had an intrinsic sacredness of its own, men are willing to sacrifice and live by and die for words. In this culture, a court of law can ask a witness to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God, and expect the truth to be told. But one can transport this court to India, as did the British, with no real success on the matter of perjury, because the Indian mythos is different, and this sacredness of words is not felt in the same way. Similar problems have occurred in this country among minority groups with different cultural backgrounds. There are endless examples of how mythos differences, direct behavior differences, and they're all fascinating. The mythos over logos argument points to the fact that each child is born as ignorant as any caveman. What keeps the world from reverting to the Neanderthal with each generation is the continuing, ongoing mythos, transformed into logos, but still mythos, the huge body of common knowledge that unites our minds as cells are united in the body of man. To feel that one is not so united, that one can accept or discard this mythos as one pleases, is not to understand what the mythos is. There is only one kind of person, Phaedrus said, who accepts or rejects the mythos in which he lives. And the definition of that person, when he has rejected the mythos, Phaedrus said, is insane. To go outside the mythos is to become insane. My God, that just came to me now. I never knew that before. He knew. He must have known what was about to happen. It's starting to open up. You have all these fragments, like pieces of a puzzle, and you can place them together into large groups, but the groups don't go together no matter how you try. And then suddenly you get one fragment, and it fits two different groups. And then suddenly the two great groups are one. The relation of the mythos to insanity. That's a key fragment. I doubt whether anyone ever said that before. Insanity is the terra incognita surrounding the mythos. And he knew. He knew the quality he talked about lay outside the mythos. Now it comes. Because quality is the generator of the mythos. That's it. That's what he meant when he said quality is the continuing stimulus which causes us to create the world in which we live. All of it. Every last bit of it. Religion isn't invented by man. Men are invented by religion. Men invent responses to quality, and among these responses is an understanding of what they themselves are. You know something, and then the quality stimulus hits, and then you try to define the quality stimulus. But to define it, all you've got to work with is what you know. So your definition is made up of what you know. It's an analog to what you already know. It has to be. It can't be anything else. And the mythos grows this way, by analogies to what is known before. The mythos is a building of analogs upon analogs upon analogs. These fill the boxcars of the train of consciousness. The mythos is the whole train of collective consciousness of all communicating mankind, every last bit of it. The quality is the track that directs the train. What is outside the train, to either side, that is the terra incognita of the insane. He knew that to understand quality, he would have to leave the mythos. That's why he felt that slippage. He knew something was about to happen. I see Chris returning through the trees now. He looks relaxed and happy. He shows me a piece of bark and asks if he can save it as a souvenir. I haven't been fond of loading the cycle with these bits and pieces he finds and will probably throw away when he gets home. But this time, say okay anyway. After a few minutes, the road reaches a summit and then drops steeply into a valley that becomes more exquisite as we descend. I never thought I would call a valley that, exquisite, but there's something about this whole coastal country so different from any other mountainous region in America that it brings out the word. Here, a little farther south, is where all our good wine comes from. The hills are somehow tucked and folded differently, exquisitely. The road twists and banks and curlicues and descends, and we in the cycle smoothly roll with it, following it in a separate grace of our own, almost touching the waxen leaves of shrubs and overhanging boughs of trees. The firs and rocks of the higher country are behind us now, and around us are soft hills and vines and purple and red flowers, fragrance mixed with wood smoke up from the distant fog along the valley floor, and from beyond that, unseen, a vague scent of ocean. How can I love all this so much and be insane? I don't believe it. The mythos. The mythos is insane. That's what he believed. The mythos that says the forms of this world are real, but the quality of this world is unreal, that is insane. And in Aristotle and the ancient Greeks, he believed he had found the villains who had so shaped the mythos as to cause us to accept this insanity as reality. That now. That ties it all together. It feels relieving when that happens. It's so hard sometimes to conjure all this up. A strange sort of exhaustion follows. Sometimes I think I'm just making it up myself. Sometimes I'm not sure. And sometimes I know I'm not. But the mythos and insanity, and the centrality of this I'm sure is from him. When we're through the folded hills, we come to Medford, and a freeway leading to Grant's Pass, and it's almost evening. A heavy headwind keeps us just up with traffic on upgrades, even with the throttle wide open. Coming into Grant's Pass, we hear a frightening, loud, clanking noise, and stop to discover that the chain guard has become caught in the chain somehow, and now is all torn up. Not too serious, but enough to lay us up for a while to get it replaced. Foolish to replace it, perhaps, when the cycle will be sold in a few days. Grant's Pass looks like a big enough town to have a motorcycle place open the next morning, and when we arrive, I look for a motel. We haven't seen a bed since Bozeman, Montana. We find one with color TV, heated swimming pool, a coffee maker for the next morning, soap, white towels, a shower all tiled, and clean beds. We lie down on the clean beds, and Chris just bounces on his for a while. Bouncing on beds, I remember from childhood, is a great depression reliever. Tomorrow, somehow, all this can be worked out, maybe. Not now. Chris goes down for a heated swim while I lie quietly on the clean bed and put everything out of mind. Chapter 29. In the process of taking stuff out of the saddlebags and cramming it back ever since Bozeman, and doing the same with the backpacks, we've acquired some exceptionally beat-up gear. Spread out all over the floor in the morning light, it looks a mess. The plastic bag with the oily stuff in it is broken and oil has gotten onto the roll of toilet paper. The clothes have been so squashed they look as if they have permanent built-in wrinkles. The soft metal tube of sunburn ointment has burst, leaving white crud all over the machete scabbard and a fragrant smell everywhere. The tube of ignition grease has burst, too. What a mess. In my shirt pocket notebook, I write down, "Buy tackle box for squeezed stuff," and then add, "Do laundry." Then, "Buy toenail scissors, sunburn cream, ignition grease, chain guard, toilet paper." This is a lot of things to do before checkout time, so I wake up Chris and tell him to get up. We have to do the laundry. At the laundromat, I instruct Chris on how to operate the dryer, start the washing machines, and take off for the other items. I get everything but a chain guard. The parts man says they don't have one and don't expect to get one. I think about riding without the chain guard for what little time is left, but that will throw crud all over and could be dangerous. Also, I don't want to do things with that presumption. That commits me to it. Down the street, I find a welder's sign and enter. Cleanest welding place I've ever seen. Great high trees and deep grass line an open space in back, giving a kind of village smithy appearance. All the tools are hung up with care, everything tidy, but no one is home. I'll come back later. I wheel back and stop for Chris, check the laundry he's put in the dryer, and putt along through the cheerful streets looking for a restaurant. Traffic everywhere. Alert, well-maintained cars, most of them. West Coast. Hazy, clean sunlight of a town out of the range of the coal vendors. At the edge of town, we find a restaurant and sit and wait at a red and white tablecloth table. Chris unfolds a copy of Motorcycle News, which I bought at the cycle shop, and reads out loud who has won all the races, and an item about cross-country cycling. The waitress looks at him, a little curiously, and then at me, then at my cycle boots, then jots down our order. She goes back into the kitchen and comes out again and looks at us. I guess that she's paying so much attention to us because we're alone here. While we wait, she puts some coins in the jukebox, and when breakfast comes, waffles, syrup, and sausages, we have music with it. Chris and I talk about what he sees in motorcycle news, and we are talking over the noise of the record in the relaxed way people talk, who have been many days on the road together, and out of the corner of my eye I see that this is watched with a steady gaze. After a while, Chris has to ask me some questions a second time because that gaze kind of beats on me, and it's hard to think of what he's saying. The record is a country western about a truck driver. I finish the conversation with Chris. As we leave and go out and start up the cycle, there she is in the door watching us. Lonely. She probably doesn't understand that with a look like that, she isn't going to be lonely long. I kick the starter and gun the engine too hard, frustrated by something, and as we ride for the welder again, it takes a while to snap out. The welder is in, an old man in his 60s or 70s, and he looks at me disdainfully, a complete reversal from the waitress. I explain about the chain guard, and after a while he says, "I'm not taking it off for you. You'll have to take it off." I do this and show it to him, and he says, "It's full of grease." I find a stick out and back, under the spreading chestnut tree, and scrape all the grease into a trash barrel. From a distance he says, "There's some solvent in that pan over there." I see the flat pan and get out the remaining grease, with some leaves and the solvent. When I show it to him, he nods and slowly goes over and sets the regulators for his gas torch. Then he looks at the tip and selects another one. Absolutely no hurry. He picks up a steel filler rod, and I wonder if he's actually going to try to weld that thin metal. Sheet metal I don't weld. I braze it with a brass rod. When I try to weld it, I punch holes in it, and then have to patch them up with huge blobs of filler rod. "Aren't you going to braze it?" I ask. "No," he says. Talkative fellow. He sparks the torch and sets a little tiny blue flame, and then, it's hard to describe, actually dances the torch and the rod in separate little rhythms over the thin sheet metal. The whole spot a uniform luminous orange-yellow, dropping the torch and filler rod down at the exact right moment and then removing them. No holes. You can hardly see the weld. "That's beautiful," I say. $1, he says, without smiling. Then I catch a funny quizzical look within his glance. Does he wonder if he's overcharged? No, something else. Lonely, same as the waitress. Probably he thinks I'm bullshitting him. Who appreciates work like this anymore? We're packed and out of the motel at just about checkout time and are soon into the coastal redwood forest, across out of Oregon, into California. The traffic is so heavy we don't have time to look up. It's turning cold and gray and we stop and put on sweaters and jackets. It's still cold, somewhere in the low 50s, and we think winter thoughts. Lonely people back in town. I saw it in the supermarket and at the laundromat and when we checked out from the motel. These pickup campers through the redwoods, full of lonely retired people looking at trees on their way to look at the ocean. You catch it in the first fraction of a glance from a new face, that searching look. Then it's gone. We see much more of this loneliness now. It's paradoxical that where people are the most closely crowded, in the big coastal cities in the east and west, the loneliness is the greatest. Back where people were so spread out in western Oregon and Idaho and Montana and the Dakotas, you'd think the loneliness would have been greater, but we didn't see it so much. The explanation, I suppose, is that the physical distance between people has nothing to do with loneliness. It's psychic distance, and in Montana and Idaho, the physical distances are big, but the psychic distances between people are small. And here it's reversed. It's the primary America we're in. It hit the night before last in Prineville Junction, and it's been with us ever since. There's this primary America of freeways and jet flights and TV and movie spectaculars. And people caught up in this primary America seem to go through huge portions of their lives without much consciousness of what's immediately around them. The media have convinced them that what's right around them is unimportant, and that's why they're lonely. You see it in their faces. First a little flicker of searching, and then when they look at you, you're just a kind of an object. You don't count. You're not what they're looking for. You're not on TV. But in the secondary America we've been through, of back roads and Chinaman's ditches and Appaloosa horses, and sweeping mountain ranges and meditative thoughts, and kids with pine cones and bumblebees and open sky above us, mile after mile after mile, all through that, what was real, what was around us, dominated. And so there wasn't much feeling of loneliness. That's the way it must have been 100 or 200 years ago. Hardly any people, and hardly any loneliness. I'm undoubtedly overgeneralizing, but if the proper qualifications were introduced, it would be true. Technology is blamed for a lot of this loneliness, since the loneliness is certainly associated with the newer technological devices, TV, jets, freeways, and so on. But I hope it's been made plain that the real evil isn't the objects of technology, but the tendency of technology to isolate people into lonely attitudes of objectivity. It's the objectivity, the dualistic way of looking at things, underlying technology, that produces the evil. That's why I went to so much trouble to show how technology could be used to destroy the evil. A person who knows how to fix motorcycles, with quality, is less likely to run short of friends than one who doesn't. And they aren't going to see him as some kind of object either. Quality destroys objectivity every time. Or if he takes whatever dull job he's stuck with, and they are all, sooner or later, dull, and just to keep himself amused, starts to look for options of quality, and secretly pursues these options, just for their own sake, thus making an art out of what he is doing, he's likely to discover that he becomes a much more interesting person, and much less of an object to the people around him because his quality decisions change him, too. And not only the job and him, but others too, because the quality tends to fan out like waves. The quality job he didn't think anyone was going to see is seen, and the person who sees it feels a little better because of it, and is likely to pass that feeling on to others, and in that way, the quality tends to keep on going. My personal feeling is that this is how any further improvement of the world will be done. By individuals making quality decisions, and that's all. God, I don't want to have any more enthusiasm for big programs full of social planning for big masses of people that leave individual quality out. These can be left alone for a while. There's a place for them, but they've got to be built on a foundation of quality within the individuals involved. We've had that individual quality in the past, exploited it as a natural resource without knowing it, and now it's just about depleted. Everyone's just about out of gumption, and I think it's about time to return to the rebuilding of this American resource, individual worth. There are political reactionaries who've been saying something close to this for years. I'm not one of them. But to the extent they're talking about real individual worth and not just an excuse for giving more money to the rich, they're right. We do need a return to individual integrity, self-reliance, and old-fashioned gumption. We really do. I hope that in this Chautauqua, some directions have been pointed to. Phaedrus went a different path from the idea of individual, personal quality decisions. I think it was a wrong one, but perhaps if I were in his circumstances, I would go his way too. He felt that the solution started with a new philosophy, or he saw it as even broader than that, a new spiritual rationality, in which the ugliness and the loneliness and the spiritual blankness of dualistic technological reason would become illogical. Reason was no longer to be value-free. Reason was to be subordinate, logically, to quality, and he was sure he would find the cause of its not being so back among the ancient Greeks. whose mythos had endowed our culture with the tendency underlying all the evil of our technology, the tendency to do what is reasonable even when it isn't any good. That was the root of the whole thing. Right there. I said a long time ago that he was in pursuit of the ghost of reason. This is what I meant. Reason and quality had become separated and in conflict with each other, and quality had been forced under, and reason made supreme somewhere back then. It's begun to rain a little. Not so much we have to stop, though. Just the faint beginnings of a drizzle. The road leads out of the tall forests now, and into open gray skies. Along the road are many billboards. Chenley's in warm-painted colors goes on forever, but one gets the feeling that Irma's gives tired, mediocre permanence because of the way the paint is cracking on her sign. I have since read Aristotle again, looking for the massive evil that appears in the fragments from Phaedrus, but have not found it there. What I find in Aristotle is mainly a quite dull collection of generalizations, many of which seem impossible to justify in the light of modern knowledge, whose organization appears extremely poor, and which seems primitive in the way old Greek pottery in the museums seems primitive. I'm sure if I knew a lot more about it, I would see a lot more, and not find it primitive at all. But without knowing all that, I can't see that it lives up either to the raves of the Great Books group, or the rages of Phaedrus. I certainly don't see Aristotle's works as a major source of either positive or negative values. But the raves of the Great Books group are well known and published. Phaedrus's rages aren't, and it becomes part of my obligation to dwell on these. Rhetoric is an art, Aristotle began, because it can be reduced to a rational system of order. That just left Phaedrus aghast. Stopped. He'd been prepared to decode messages of great subtlety, systems of great complexity in order to understand the deeper inner meaning of Aristotle, claimed by many to be the greatest philosopher of all time. And then to get hit, right off, straight in the face, with an asshole statement like that. It really shook him. He read on. Rhetoric can be subdivided into particular proofs and topics on the one hand, and common proofs on the other. The particular proofs can be subdivided into methods of proof and kinds of proof. The methods of proofs are the artificial proofs and the inartificial proofs. Of the artificial proofs, there are ethical proofs, emotional proofs, and logical proofs. Of the ethical proofs, there are practical wisdom, virtue, and goodwill. The particular methods employing artificial proofs of the ethical kind involving goodwill require a knowledge of the emotions. And for those who have forgotten what these are, Aristotle provides a list. They are anger, slight, subdivisible into contempt, spite, and insolence, mildness, love or friendship, fear, confidence, shame, shamelessness, favor, benevolence, pity, virtuous indignation, envy, emulation, and contempt. Remember the description of the motorcycle given way back in South Dakota? The one which carefully enumerated all the motorcycle parts and functions? Recognize the similarity? Here, Phaedrus was convinced, was the originator of that style of discourse. For page after page, Aristotle went on like this. Like some third-rate technical instructor, naming everything, showing the relationships among the things named, cleverly inventing an occasional new relationship among the things named, and then waiting for the bell so we can get on to repeat the lecture for the next class. Between the lines, Phaedrus read no doubts, no sense of awe, only the eternal smugness of the professional academician. Did Aristotle really think his students would be better rhetoricians for having learned all these endless names and relationships? And if not, did he really think he was teaching rhetoric? Phaedrus thought that he really did. There was nothing in his style to indicate that Aristotle was ever one to doubt Aristotle. Phaedrus saw Aristotle as tremendously satisfied with this neat little stunt of naming and classifying everything. His world began and ended with this stunt. The reason why, if he were not more than 2,000 years dead, he would have gladly rubbed him out, is that he saw him as a prototype for the many millions of self-satisfied and truly ignorant teachers throughout history, who have smugly and callously killed the creative spirit of their students with this dumb ritual of analysis, this blind, rote, eternal naming of things. Walk into any of 100,000 classrooms today and hear the teachers divide and subdivide and interrelate and establish principles and study methods. And what you will hear is the ghost of Aristotle speaking down through the centuries, the desiccating, lifeless voice of dualistic reason. The sessions on Aristotle were round an enormous wooden round table in a dreary room across the street from a hospital, where the late afternoon sun from over the hospital roof hardly penetrated the window dirt and polluted city air beyond. Wan and pale and depressing. During the middle of the hour, he noticed that this enormous table had a huge crack that ran right across it near the middle. It looked as though it had been there for years, but that no one had thought to repair it. Too busy, no doubt, with more important things. At the end of the hour, he finally asked, "May questions about Aristotle's rhetoric be asked?" "If you have read the material," he was told. He noticed in the eye of the professor of philosophy the same set he had seen the first day of registration. He took warning from it that he had better read the material very thoroughly, and did so. The rain comes down more heavily now, and we stop to snap on the face mask to the helmet. Then we go again at moderate speed. I watch for chuck holes, sand, and grease slicks. The next week, Phaedrus had read the material, and was prepared to take apart the statement that rhetoric is an art because it can be reduced to a rational system of order. By this criterion, General Motors produced pure art, whereas Picasso did not. If there were deeper meanings to Aristotle than met the eye, this would be as good a place as any to make them visible. But the question never got raised. Phaedrus put up his hand to do so, caught a microsecond flash of malice from the teacher's eye, but then another student said, almost as an interruption, "I think there are some very dubious statements here." That was all he got out. "Sir, we are not here to learn what you think," hissed the professor of philosophy, like acid. "We are here to learn what Aristotle thinks." Straight in the face. "When we wish to learn what you think, we will assign a course in the subject." Silence. The student is stunned. So is everyone else. But the professor of philosophy is not done. He points his finger at the student and demands, "According to Aristotle, what are the three kinds of particular rhetoric according to subject matter discussed?" More silence. The student doesn't know. "Then you haven't read it, have you?" And now, with a gleam that indicates he has intended this all along, the professor of philosophy swings his finger around and points it at Phaedrus. "You, sir, what are the three kinds of particular rhetoric according to subject matter discussed?" But Phaedrus is prepared. "Forensic, deliberative, and epideictic," he answers calmly. "What are the epideictic techniques?" "The technique of identifying likenesses, the technique of praise, that of encomium, and that of amplification." "Yes," says the professor of philosophy slowly. Then all is silent. The other students look shocked. They wonder what has happened. Only Phaedrus knows, and perhaps the professor of philosophy. An innocent student has caught blows intended for him. Now everyone's face becomes carefully composed in defense against more of this sort of questioning. The professor of philosophy has made a mistake. He's wasted his disciplinary authority on an innocent student, while Phaedrus, the guilty one, the hostile one, is still at large, and getting larger and larger. Since he has asked no questions, there is now no way to cut him down. And now that he sees how the questions will be answered, he's certainly not about to ask them. The innocent student stares down at the table, face red, hands shrouding his eyes. His shame becomes Phaedrus's anger. In all his classes, he never once talked to a student like that. So that's how they teach classics at the University of Chicago. Phaedrus knows the professor of philosophy now, but the professor of philosophy doesn't know Phaedrus. The gray rainy skies and sign-strewn road descend to Crescent City, California, gray and cold and wet, and Chris and I look and see the water, the ocean in the distance, beyond piers and gray buildings. I remember this was our great goal all these days. We enter a restaurant with a fancy red carpet and fancy menus with extremely high prices. We are the only people here. We eat silently, pay, and are on the road again, south now, cold and misty. In the next sessions, the shamed student is no longer present. No surprise. The class is completely frozen, as is inevitable when an incident like that has taken place. Each session, just one person does all the talking, the professor of philosophy. And he talks and talks and talks to faces that have turned into masks of neutrality. The professor of philosophy seems quite aware of what has happened. His previous little eye flick of malice toward Phaedrus has turned into a little eye flick of fear. He seems to understand that within the present classroom situation, when the time comes, he can get exactly the same treatment he gave, and there will be no sympathy from any of the faces before him. He's thrown away his right to courtesy. There's no way to prevent retaliation now, except to keep covered. But to keep covered, he must work hard and say things exactly right. Phaedrus understands this too. By remaining silent, he can now learn under what are very advantageous circumstances. Phaedrus studied hard during this period, and learned extremely fast, and kept his mouth shut. But it would be wrong to give the least impression that he was any sort of good student. A good student seeks knowledge fairly and impartially. Phaedrus did not. He had an axe to grind, and all he sought were those things that helped him grind it, and the means of knocking down anything which prevented him from grinding it. He had no time for or interest in other people's great books. He was there solely to write a great book of his own. His attitude toward Aristotle was grossly unfair for the same reason Aristotle was unfair to his predecessors. They fouled up what he wanted to say. Aristotle fouled up what Phaedrus wanted to say by placing rhetoric in an outrageously minor category in his hierarchic order of things. It was a branch of practical science, a kind of shirt-tail relation to the other category, theoretical science, which Aristotle was mainly involved in. As a branch of practical science, it was isolated from any concern with truth or good or beauty, except as devices to throw into an argument. Thus, quality, in Aristotle's system, is totally divorced from rhetoric. This contempt for rhetoric, combined with Aristotle's own atrocious quality of rhetoric, so completely alienated Phaedrus he couldn't read anything Aristotle said without seeking ways to despise it and attack it. This was no problem. Aristotle has always been eminently attackable and eminently attacked throughout history, and shooting down Aristotle's patent absurdities, like shooting fish in a barrel, didn't afford much satisfaction. If he hadn't been so partial, Phaedrus might have learned some valuable Aristotelian techniques of bootstrapping oneself into new areas of knowledge, which was what the committee was really set up for. But if he hadn't been so partial in his search for a place to launch his work on quality, he wouldn't have been there in the first place, so it really didn't have any chance to work out at all. The professor of philosophy lectured, and Phaedrus listened to both the classic form and romantic surface of what was said. The professor of philosophy seemed most ill at ease on the subject of dialectic. Although Phaedrus couldn't figure out why in terms of classic form, his growing romantic sensitivity told him he was on the scent of something. A quarry. Dialectic, eh? Aristotle's book had begun with it in a most mystifying way. Rhetoric is a counterpart of dialectic, it had said, as if this were of the greatest importance. Yet why this was so important was never explained. It was followed by a number of other disjointed statements, which gave the impression that a great deal had been left out, or the material had been assembled wrongly, or the printer had left something out, because no matter how many times he read it, nothing gelled. The only thing that was clear was that Aristotle was very much concerned about the relation of rhetoric to dialectic. To Phaedrus's ear, the same ill-ease he had observed in the professor of philosophy appeared here. The professor of philosophy had defined dialectic, and Phaedrus had listened carefully, but it was in one ear and out the other, a characteristic that philosophic statements often have when something is left out. In a later class, another student who seemed to be having the same trouble asked the professor of philosophy to redefine dialectic, and this time the professor had glanced at Phaedrus with another quick flicker of fear and become very edgy. Phaedrus began to wonder if dialectic had some special meaning that made it a fulcrum word, one that can shift the balance of an argument depending on how it's placed. It was. Dialectic generally means of the nature of the dialogue, which is a conversation between two persons. Nowadays, it means logical argumentation. It involves a technique of cross-examination by which truth is arrived at. It's the mode of discourse of Socrates in the dialogues of Plato. Plato believed the dialectic was the sole method by which the truth was arrived at, the only one. That's why it's a fulcrum word. Aristotle attacked this belief, saying that the dialectic was only suitable for some purposes, to inquire into men's beliefs, to arrive at truths about external forms of things, known as ideas, which were fixed and unchanging and constituted reality for Plato. Aristotle said there is also the method of science, or physical method, which observes physical facts and arrives at truths about substances which undergo change. This duality of form and substance, and the scientific method of arriving at facts about substances, were central to Aristotle's philosophy. Thus, the dethronement of dialectic, from what Socrates and Plato held it to be, was absolutely essential for Aristotle. And dialectic was, and still is, a fulcrum word. Phaedrus guessed that Aristotle's diminution of dialectic from Plato's sole method of arriving at truth to a counterpart of rhetoric might be as infuriating to modern Platonists as it would have been to Plato. Since the professor of philosophy didn't know what Phaedrus's position was, this was what was making him edgy. He might be afraid that Phaedrus, the Platonist, was going to jump him. If so, he certainly had nothing to worry about. Phaedrus wasn't insulted that dialectic had been brought down to the level of rhetoric. He was outraged that rhetoric had been brought down to the level of dialectic. Such was the confusion at the time. The person to clear all this up, of course, was Plato, and fortunately he was the next to appear at the round table with the crack running across the middle in the dim, dreary room across from the hospital building in South Chicago. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig, continued. Cassette 10, Side 1. The person to clear all this up, of course, was Plato, and fortunately he was the next to appear at the round table with the crack running across the middle in the dim, dreary room, across from the hospital building in South Chicago. We follow the coast now, cold, wet, and depressed. The rain has let up temporarily, but the sky shows no hope. At one point I see a beach and some people walking on it in the wet sand. I'm tired, and so I stop. As he gets off, Chris says, "What are we stopping for?" "I'm tired," I say. The wind blows cold off the ocean, and where it has formed dunes, now wet and dark from the rain that must have just ended here, I find a place to lie down, and this makes me a little warmer. I don't sleep, though. A little girl appears over the top of the dune, looking as though she wants me to come and play. After a while, she goes away. In time, Chris comes back and wants to go. He says he has found some funny plants out on the rocks that have feelers which pull in when you touch them. I go with him and see between rises of waves in the rocks that they are sea anemones, which are not plants but animals. I tell him the tentacles can paralyze small fish. The tide must be all the way out, or he wouldn't see these, I say. From the corner of my eye, I see the little girl on the other side of the rocks has picked up a starfish. Her parents are carrying some starfish, too. We get on the motorcycle and move south. Sometimes the rain gets heavy, and I snap on the bubble so it doesn't sting my face. But I don't like this and take it off when the rain dies away. We should reach Arcata before dark, but I don't want to go too fast on this wet road. I think it was Coleridge who said everyone is either a Platonist or an Aristotelian. People who can't stand Aristotle's endless specificity of detail are natural lovers of Plato's soaring generalities. People who can't stand the eternal lofty idealism of Plato welcome the down-to-earth facts of Aristotle. Plato is the essential Buddha seeker who appears again and again in each generation, moving onward and upward toward the One. Aristotle is the eternal motorcycle mechanic who prefers the many. I myself am pretty much Aristotelian in this sense, preferring to find the Buddha